You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Incinerators were kind of an early environmental fad about 40 years ago. Today, there are fewer than 100 of them in the United States, and this incinerator in Long Beach is one of only two left in California. And its future, well, that's a topic of hot debate. You hear that scraping metal sound? Well, that's the incinerator's filter, separating out particulate pollution. Cities all over Southern California send their trash to get burned here in Long Beach. And today, this is viewed as a greener alternative to tossing it in the landfill. But that doesn't mean the smoke from burning garbage is healthy. And it's the people living nearby who suffer the most.
We treat certain communities like they're sacrifice zones or they're disposable in exchange for everyone else's comfort, convenience, and for some of these companies, their bottom line and their profit out there.
Assemblymember Christina Garcia represents part of Southeast LA County, upwind of this incinerator, and she wants this facility to go up in smoke.
And so for myself, it's been a long quest, you know, of how do we actually stop treating these communities like they're second-class citizens and let them live a healthier existence like neighbors in wealthier zip codes.
Last week, Garcia introduced a bill meant to discourage use of this place. But if this incinerator dies, what happens to all the garbage? Can we really recycle and reduce our way out of all this waste? KCRW's Kaylee Wells picks up the story from here.
Every year, this incinerator takes 500,000 tons of waste and turns it into 150,000 tons of toxic ash. I know that sounds bad, but the incinerator is not just making pollution. There's a reason this is still considered greener than a landfill. Here's why. Let's say I live in Long Beach and I throw out a plastic fork. The city picks it up and dumps it here on the western edge of Long Beach next to Wilmington. It gets inspected and then a hydraulic ram shoves my fork into a furnace.
And that's where the combustion takes place, and takes maybe hour and a half, 2 hours to get from the front end to the back end.
That's Alan Foley with the City of Long Beach. So what you're left with is a bunch of ash, which goes into a tank full of water to wet it down so the ash doesn't go flying everywhere. Then here comes the good news. The ash of my fork still gets shipped off to the landfill, but it serves a purpose. Like sometimes it gets turned into the gravel that gets laid over a full section of the landfill so vehicles can drive over it. Plus the energy created from that process gets repurposed.
The heating of the garbage turns the water to steam, sends steam through a turbine, turns a generator, and we generate, at full load, we generate about 35 megawatts of electricity,
which powers the incinerator and up to 30,000 homes. Sounds cool, right? I mean, toxic ash is better than sending all that stuff to landfill where it rots and releases potent greenhouse gases. But it's 2022. We don't have to pick between the lesser of two evils. That's what Associate Attorney Byron Chan from Earth Justice says.
The idea that it's either incineration or landfill, I think, is a false choice that's being presented as a justification for continuing to burn trash. But we know in 2022 that there are a variety of different strategies besides incineration and landfilling, right? So you're thinking about recycling, you're thinking about composting, you're thinking about reuse, right? And source reduction.
Here's the less cool part about the incinerator. Cities across Southern California, from Santa Ana to San Bernardino, ship their stuff here. So say we threw away that plastic fork in Victorville. First, it gets shipped 100 miles on a gas-powered truck to Long Beach, and then it gets burned at the incinerator, which releases toxins into the air.
We found investigations from inspectors who noted that ash was escaping the facility and into the community, that it was clogging drains, for example, on the facility, and that it was just really clouding the air that the inspector was breathing in.
And then the leftover ash gets put on another gas-powered truck, and that truck drives another 60 miles to a landfill in Corona. A report by Earth Justice found that energy generated by burning my fork and all the trash it came in with releases more carbon dioxide than a coal plant creating the same amount of energy. Then, of course, there's the air pollution that comes from burning toxic ash. The gases emitted from the incinerator are getting inhaled by people like Whitney Amaya, who lives a few miles away. She's an organizer with East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice.
It really doesn't make any sense, and it's not fair that, you know, for myself, for my family, and for my friends, we have to continue breathing dirty air from, you know, garbage that's coming from so many different places.
And that's another problem. The vast majority of incinerators are in marginalized communities. This one is no different. The report from Earth Justice found that more than 80% of people living within 5 miles of the Long Beach incinerator are people of color. Their per capita income is less than $30,000. It's hard to tell how much of the pollution that Amaya is breathing in comes from the incinerator because she also lives near a freeway and a refinery and the ports of LA and Long Beach. But we do know that the incinerator is releasing carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, all these toxins that are already exceeding the EPA's allowable limits in nearby communities.
I think our communities are often ignored. And it's also the reason why we see these facilities in our neighborhoods in the first place, that we're kind of, you know, just seen as like, just put it in their community. They'll deal with it.
Why would a city burn their trash anyway? Well, there's incentives built into state law. Cities are required to reduce, recycle, or compost half of their waste. And that law allows you to count 10% of your waste toward that reduction goal if you send it to get burned in an incinerator. Here's where Assemblymember Christina Garcia's bill comes in.
So this bill is getting rid of that 10% loophole and making it clear that burning trash is not a diversion, it's not recycling, and it's not healthy.
But why talk about it now? Well, because of another problem with the incinerator. It's life expectancy. Here's Chan again.
So as these facilities are aging, it's costing cities more and more money to keep these facilities running.
Most incinerators are built to live about 30 years. The one in Long Beach turns 34 this year.
So that's, you know, money that basically the residents of Long Beach are spending to then suffer from pollution and ash, and also money that instead of going towards zero waste strategies is going towards this aging and outdated way of managing our waste.
In fact, an incinerator in Commerce closed for those reasons in 2018. Long Beach is rapidly heading toward a pivotal decision. Keep paying for this old incinerator while others are shutting down, or stop investing in it and ride it till it dies. On one side, the company that owns the incinerator and the sanitation districts that run it. Here's Foley.
The idea of zero waste is a good idea, but by closing us down, that's not going to get you any closer to that goal. It's just going to be landfill.
And on the other side, here's Chan.
We're not talking about shutting down the incinerator so that more waste can go to a landfill. We're talking about shutting down the incinerator and then investing money in zero waste strategies so that waste can be diverted.
If Garcia's bill does pass this year, it will be harder for cities to use and fund the incinerator. What the bill doesn't do is mandate where our trash will go instead. Foley says it's not that he doesn't support waste reduction, but shutting the incinerator won't make waste go away.
Recycle, reduce everything you can, and send us the rest. We're not stifling recycling. We're not stifling reduction. I guess if you could put us out of business because there's no more garbage to process through the facility, I'd applaud you. But that's just not the case.
At the moment, the Long Beach incinerator has gotten funding through 2024. The hope for environmental justice advocates is that municipalities will stop investing to keep this incinerator open and instead use that money to recycle more, compost more, and divert more waste and ash from landfills. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, Steve Chiatakis here. When you think of a computer hacker, you probably visualize some nerdy guy tapping away at his computer until he screams, "I'm in!" At least that's what Hollywood typically gives us.
Let the hacking begin.
They're at Grand Central Station,
lower level. Don't screw up.
Anybody want to black out New England?
They change the password every couple of weeks, but I know where they write it down.
He knows where they write it down. Of course, everything's back from the 1980s. Well, in the 80s, Los Angeles had a much different type of hacker, Susie Thunder. Susan Headley was her real name. You've probably never heard of her because she never got caught. Well, writer and musician Claire L. Evans spent a year tracking Susie down during the pandemic, and she wrote about it for The Verge. Hey, Claire.
Hi.
How'd you hear about Susie Thunder, and what made you want to find her so badly?
Well, she's kind of a mythological figure in hacking history. She's this very notorious hacker from the 80s who basically disappeared off the face of the earth after about 1984 or 5. And I'm interested in tech history. I wrote a book about women in computing history, and Susie was, I guess, kind of my white whale. And so I made it my pandemic project to find the great lost female hacker of the 80s. I mean, what else did I have going on?
Exactly. Well, there's that mystery. Remember the guy who was in the airplane, stole some money, right? Had the bag of money.
Yes.
And he and the bag of money disappeared from the aircraft, right? Like,
yes, she's the D.B. Cooper of hacking.
She's the D.B. Cooper. She's the D.B. Cooper of hacking. Well, her obsession with hacking begins with the telephone. When she was a kid living in La Crescenta, her father left when she was young. She was then abused by her mother's boyfriend when she was 9. Why did she turn to the telephone?
Well, it was a place where she could be herself, or even better, be somebody else. Most people don't remember this, but in the 1970s, Los Angeles was kind of a hotbed of telephone culture. Actually, for a time in the 70s, the most dialed private telephone number in the world was an answering machine service on the floor of a shoe closet in West LA that just hosted recordings of jokes and sketches. And there were dozens of phone services like this, joke lines and conference lines. And I mean, it's essentially like a chat room. So Susie, young Susie, who felt really alone in her life, was able to connect with lots of other people, make friends, and kind of lose herself in this magical and forgotten world of 1970s telephone culture. And that's kind of where it all began for her.
When did it turn into something a bit more serious and sinister?
Well, that's a complicated question. But I think for her, she experienced a lot of traumatic events in her childhood. She, as you mentioned, was abused by her stepfather.
Yeah.
And I think for her, the appeal of first prank calls and then later more sophisticated forms of telephone-based manipulation and then ultimately hacking were a way for her to regain control over her life and feel like she had power.
Well, and again, it's as we both recalled, I mean, she was abused when she was younger. She ran away from home, right, when she was 14?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she ran away from home and became a rock star groupie.
In 1970s Hollywood, right? I mean, a groupie in, I mean, Hollywood could be a pretty seedy place.
Yes, it was a seedy place. And looking back on it now, there are a lot of things about that time that are shocking to me. I mean, when I was researching this piece, reading about the teenage groupie scene of the Sunset Strip in the 70s, I mean, Susie being 14 years old and, you know, getting backstage access and hanging out with these rock stars. But it's also a place where she refined her skills as a hacker, because she learned how to use her kind of exceptional ability to manipulate other people over the phone to get herself backstage passes and to get herself access to industry events where she could meet rock stars. She actually took a job as a teenager working at a telephone office, which gave her this unbelievable access to people's whereabouts, because it used to be before the days of home answering machines, you would use an answering service, and those answering services would know kind of like the whereabouts of a lot of people as they were coming and going. And so she would take all that information, combine it with what she was learning on the scene, and use it to her advantage. And she found herself in all kinds of situations where her wits really got her into places where nobody else could go.
She was also involved in one of the first prosecutions for an electronic intrusion, I understand, under California's computer crime statute. Is that right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that's quite a saga. I mean, basically, in the late 70s, early 80s, Susan got in with a group of young telephone freakers, with a PH. Freakers were people who were incredibly interested in the phone system. They're kind of the predecessors to modern day hackers. They were hackers, but on the phone, not on the computer. And Susie got mixed up with a group of freakers who then became computer freakers, hackers, who, you know, they did all kinds of capers. They pulled all kinds of scams all over the city of Los Angeles for some time. They almost shut down phone service for the entire city of LA at one point. But ultimately, because of a interpersonal conflict between Susie and one of the members of this group, she testified against them and got them put away for, yeah, one of the first really like legal instances of computer crime.
You did all this research on her. Did you find her?
Yeah, of course. I found her. It took me a very long time. And I think if it hadn't been...
How long? How long did it take you?
Nearly a year. 10, 11 months.
Wow.
Yeah, I think if it hadn't been for the pandemic, I probably would have given up many times along the way. But because it was such a strange time, it was nice to have something that gave me purpose. And I just kept plodding along until finally I made a connection and began the process of getting to know her and getting her to trust me and getting her to share some of her exciting and truly fantastic stories about a very interesting moment and kind of a forgotten moment in technology history, this era of telephone freakers in Los Angeles.
Has she ever been like on the lam or on the run from law enforcement who were searching for her, you know, trying to find her vis-a-vis, you know, some kind of hacking that took place? Is she in jeopardy of being arrested or statute of limitations and all that?
No, I think she's in the clear now, but there was definitely some cat and mouse activity going on in those days. But at the same time, I could make a case for the fact that that kind of push and pull between the hackers and, you know, the institutions that they are trying to hack, that's kind of what pushes technology forward. I think hackers are innovators. I think that cat and mouse game ultimately has a huge effect on how technologies are iterated and refined. And I think someone like Susan, who has really this uncanny ability to examine an entire system and identify its weaknesses, you know, even if those weaknesses are the human points of weakness, that's part of the history of technology. That's part of what sort of changes the world for better or for worse.
You wrote an entire book about women who helped make the internet into what it is today. I mean, how has all this research on Susie Thunder changed your own views about the cyber world?
Well, you know, I think in a sense, like the people who build systems and software and platforms and hardware, like they always get the shine in history books. And of course, but you know, what actually happens after those things enter into the world? You know, they're not static and they're not neutral. The way that people choose to use them, the way they get incorporated into society and culture, and the way they get exploited by people like Susan, that's part of it all. You know, that's innovation just as much as anything else. So I'm always interested in finding and identifying the underdogs who are contributing to the larger story that maybe haven't been considered or included in the narratives that we tell ourselves about what's important when it comes to technology. Because at the end of the day, technology is an extension of human culture, and we have to make sure that we're seeing the full picture when we do that. So that's what motivates me, and that's why I love hackers.
Well, I'll see you on your MySpace page.
I think I still have one, I'm embarrassed to say.
I think we all do, actually. Claire L. Evans, who wrote the piece called Searching for Susie Thunder, which you can find online on The Verge. She's also author of Broadband, Two Words, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. And she's the lead singer, by the way, I mentioned musician, lead singer of the pop duo Yacht. Claire, good luck to you. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. When artist Noah Davis died in 2015, he left behind a legacy, not just in the art world, but also a legacy here in Los Angeles. He was a painter who was known for both portraits of everyday life in moody tones and for more surreal portraits of the living and maybe not so living. He was also known for his work with the Underground Museum. He and his wife, Carone Davis, founded this community and art space in Arlington Heights of L.A. to fulfill his dream of exhibiting museum-quality art in a working-class Black and Latino neighborhood. Well, after a long closure because of the pandemic, the Underground Museum has now reopened its doors, and their latest show is one from none other than Noah Davis. Here to give us a preview is our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, who's editor-in-chief at Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, or CARLA. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Steve.
First off, tell me a little bit about the new show. Is this a retrospective of Davis's work?
It definitely feels like a retrospective. You know, it feels like looking back at everything that he's done. But at the same time, Helen Molesworth, the former curator at MoCA, who co-curated this show with Justin Leroy, had said that she wanted to pick pieces from across Noah's work to really show the breadth of what he could do. But at the same time, she kind of held back. She didn't want to be so comprehensive that he wouldn't have another opportunity to show his work in the future. So, for instance, he left behind 400 paintings, collages, and sculptures, and this LA exhibition only has about 20 paintings. So, in a way, it's limited. It kind of feels like an introduction to the work and introducing Los Angeles, who's really come to know Noah through the Underground Museum, kind of introducing the community to his paintings. And, you know, it feels like a homecoming for Noah. It feels really significant.
I mean, just looking at his work, he did so much in so little time, right? He died so young.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what stood out to you in this exhibition?
I mean, yeah, like you said, he was just so prolific. He just painted and painted. And his paintings really keep you on your toes. You never totally know what you're going to expect. And just when you look at one and kind of think you have his style pinned down, you look at the next one and it kind of takes you aback. So for instance, some of the paintings in the show were based on photographs that Noah and his brother had found that his mother had actually taken. So you see scenes of everyday life in Chicago where she took a lot of these photos, almost like a documentary style of portraiture or picture making. But then again, you turn the corner and you have this painting called Man with Alien and Shotgun. That's a painting of a man in the center of the composition. He's holding a shotgun and an alien, kind of like a drooping alien carcass in the other hand. So the paintings allow themselves to get really surreal and dreamlike in a way that is very surprising and kind of catches you off guard. I think Noah, he always just really challenged himself. He didn't box himself into one way of painting or making art. And I've read that he often would paint over his own paintings. So he just was always trying to kind of one-up himself. And as someone who really, he loved art and art history. And you really see that broad range of influences coming through his work.
And as I mentioned, he and his wife opened the Underground Museum a few years back before he died. I mean, when did it first open and how did it get there?
Yeah, so the museum was founded in 2012, and it really was just Noah and his wife, Caron, and kind of founding the museum. They lived in the space. Noah used it as a studio. It really was a lot scrappier in its first iterations. And really was his dream of kind of bringing art to the neighborhood. So he had this dream of showing world-class, like museum-quality art in this neighborhood of Arlington Heights. And he went around and started asking museums to lend him work, and they refused because he didn't have an HVAC system. It wasn't temperature controlled, things like this. So he decided to actually make the work himself. One of the first shows that he did was in 2013, called Imitation of Wealth, and it literally was bootleg versions of historical sculptures and paintings by Jeff Koons, Robert Smithson, Anca Wara, really notable artists that Noah had just ripped off and made himself, like literal copies of these artworks. And then after that, Noah met Helen Molesworth, who was at MoCA at the time, and she agreed to partner with him to kind of make this dream a reality of bringing museum quality work. So for some years, MoCA was actually lending works from their collection to the Underground Museum, and shows that Noah had envisioned, and a lot of them took place after Noah had passed. So they were kind of carried forth posthumously and were curated shows that Noah had kind of scribed out for, Caron and Helen to really carry forth.
And this place wasn't, again, not just a museum. It was a gathering place, right, for the community.
Yeah. So, you know, Noah's mission was really to make this place a community space that welcomed people in. And it really has become that kind of community hub. In addition to exhibitions, there's a ton of events. There's movie nights, screenings, performances, poetry readings. There's a really beautiful garden space that is really kind of welcoming for the community to come in and utilize. They have a curated bookshop. So yeah, it's definitely much more than an art viewing space. And it's really a community hub that's built for the neighborhood.
Well, his show is up through September 30th, the end of September, over at the Underground Museum in Arlington Heights. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Next week, students in school, but who are living on sidewalks or in shelters. Next week on GLA, grab the podcast at kcrw.com/GLA and tell us how you're doing, too, while you're there. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Tom, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all help with tonight's episode. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your ears and time. Have a good night.